This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While attention continues to focus on the crisis in Liberia and the struggle to establish security in Iraq, there have been disturbing developments elsewhere. There's evidence of accelerating nuclear weapons programs in North Korea and Iran, though in both cases, the evidence is not conclusive. Given the controversy over intelligence and Iraq, there has been some caution on how to interpret these signs, but we wanted to bring you up to date on what could be the next crisis. Here in Washington today, Secretary of State Colin Powell said North Korea will gain no political advantage if it develops nuclear weapons.
North Korea has to understand that it has there's no future in pursuing this kind of technology, this kind of weapon. The United States will work closely with our friends and neighbors, will not allow this to become, as some have suggested, once again a U.S.-North Korea problem. It is a problem between North Korea and its neighbors, who are most directly threatened, and frankly, who have considerable influence on North Korea.
Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking today about reports that North Korea has built a second secret plant to produce weapons-grade plutonium. If you have questions about the nuclear capabilities of North Korea and Iran, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send email to us, TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Leonard Spector, a nuclear proliferation expert at the Monterey Institute, who follow these matters closely. And thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Of the two, North Korea is clearly the more alarming. Pyongyang first acknowledged its nuclear weapons program last fall. It's since thrown out a monitoring team from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN Nuclear Watchdog Group. It's withdrawn from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and now claims to have reprocessed 8,000 fuel rods into weapons-grade plutonium. And let's begin there. What do we know about that reprocessing other than North Korea's official statements?
Well, first of all, we know that the fuel rods are not where they used to be, which was fully under international supervision and specially canned so that they could remain in storage for a long time. The fuel rods have been taken from the storage area and moved elsewhere, everyone assumes, to the facility at Yeonbyang, where reprocessing can take place. There has been activity seen at that location. Even the satellite photos available publicly have shown plumes of smoke and so forth, suggesting that some operations are going on. This morning's reports implied that if something is occurring, it's still in the early stages, so that rather than having all of the plutonium in those fuel rods, which would be four or five weapons worth of material, you know, maybe they've only got a half a weapon so far added to the plutonium that they had previously made for one or two bombs.
Yeah, and Secretary Powell has said previously, quite openly, that intelligence officials believe that North Korea began this whole controversy with one or two bombs already.
That's correct, and indeed seemed to have begun the controversy back in 1994 with that capability.
Mm-hmm. More recently, sensors on the South Korean border detected elevated levels of krypton-85. It's a gas that's emitted as a byproduct when spent fuel is converted into plutonium. Disturbing enough on its own, I suppose, but computer analysis of the wind currents suggested that that gas did not come from the facility, the known facility at Yeonbyang.
I think that is a source of concern. This morning's treatment of it implied that the evidence was a bit shaky and that no one is really sure if there is a second facility. But if there were such a facility, the reason it would be of such so anxiety-provoking is that it would mean that there would be no possibility, let's say, of destroying the key plants because we wouldn't know where this other one was. And if it is already reprocessing, it means some of the fuel rods have been moved there. And it means that there has been a dispersion of this capability, which will be very hard by military means, let us say, to destroy if that were ever a consideration.
And one piece of logic that suggests that is that in many other aspects of its national security apparatus, North Korea has always opted for redundant systems.
Well, that's true, and we don't quite know how much redundancy it wants. We've learned over the last year that they have not only got the plutonium program, but also a program for enriching uranium, which is the other material, enriched uranium, that could be used in the core of a nuclear weapon. So they have a belt and suspenders approach. Maybe they've got two belts.
What about delivery systems? One thing to have the material, another to make a bomb, still a third to have the capacity to launch it at something.
Well, this is one of the very disturbing elements here. There's no question that they possess missiles able to reach South Korea, the Scuds. They have those in large numbers. They've also developed a missile called the Nodong, which can reach Japan. And then they have a longer-range system still called the Taipodong, which is in development but has the potential for eventually reaching the United States. But if you imagined a military crisis tomorrow, let's say, in the area, you not only would have to worry about the damage that could be done to Seoul, South Korea's capital, with even just artillery from the north, you have these other exposures, especially in Japan, of very damaging missile attacks, even, again, let's just say conventional weapons, but perhaps with chemical or biological as well, and eventually with nuclear.
On the one hand, there are reports that trilateral talks, the United States, North Korea, and China, could begin as soon as September 6th. On the other hand, there are worries that North Korea might declare itself to be a nuclear power, perhaps as soon as next week. July 27th would mark the 50th anniversary of the Korean War armistice.
Well, I think the actual declaration is at this point a little bit less of a concern, since everyone has attributed this capability to them. And even if there was uncertainty, let's say in the early 90s, about whether they had plutonium or not, there was questions about how much, no one doubts now that they are able to produce this. They have the spent fuel rods. They have the reprocessing plant. And I think they are perceived as a de facto nuclear power.
And what difference does that make? I mean, how does that change the situation?
Well, there are many different dimensions here. One is, of course, it does change the military balance strikingly. It's one thing to imagine a rapid American invasion that after the destruction of parts of Seoul with conventional weapons, we prevail and so on. But if there are nuclear weapons involved, and if they have the potential not only to threaten South Korea but also Japan, all of this becomes much, much graver as a potential threat. And I think it is even an additional layer of caution. It also means for negotiations, not only do you have to get them to stop the reprocessing, they have to make clear where the plutonium was eventually. They have to give it up. They have to show us where their enrichment program is and so forth. And the more that they appear to have as the negotiations begin, the more we have to accomplish in the negotiations, and every step will be extremely difficult.
So harder and harder to get that genie back in the bottle.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Our phone number again, 800-989-8255. Alex joins us on the line from Portsmouth, Virginia.
Hi. I work for the U.S. Navy, so I have a somewhat of an understanding of how much nuclear-related programs cost. And I can only assume, I don't work with weapons type stuff, but I can only assume that they have a similar kind of cost. With their economy as it is, how long can North Korea sustain this kind of program? And I can take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Alex.
Well, I think this is a very good question, and it would appear that they are able to sustain this program. They were building it up in the early 90s at a time when they were not doing well economically. They seem to have started a new dimension of it and also advanced their missile programs very significantly during the mid-1990s when they were going through dire economic times. So I have a feeling that they will bend every effort, if need be, to sustain the program. What one had hoped for at one point, or at least some had hoped for, was that the economy would be in such a poor state that the country would collapse and that all of this would become moot, let's say, although there would be a chaotic situation, to be sure. That just seems never to have happened. And even with a sort of increasing embargo that seems to be emerging around North Korea, I think they will get what they need faster than we will be able to bring them down with economic pressure.
Recently, William Perry, the widely respected Secretary of Defense during the Clinton administration, warned that the situation between Pyongyang and Washington was drifting towards war, perhaps as soon as this year. Do you agree with him?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I think the war option is so unappealing for reasons we've been talking about that it's hard to imagine that happening. Now, a military confrontation could occur over the new proliferation security initiative, the interdiction arrangements that the United States is trying to put in place to prevent shipments into North Korea of missile or nuclear-related stuff or exports from North Korea. We've already had
one. Of prohibited materials.
Prohibited materials. And we have already you know, had one episode where a ship with the Scuds was stopped off of Yemen. So that could precipitate a crisis. There could be a sense of an economic blockade or the perception of one, which could precipitate a crisis. But I think right now, at least, the administration is looking to a negotiated solution. It seems to be ready to put a lot on the table. So I think we have some options there. And there is also this other undercurrent, which is just beginning to emerge, of perhaps facilitating a sort of emptying out of North Korea. There was an article in the paper over the weekend that the administration has talked about taking 300,000 refugees from North Korea into the United States. I think if the Russians or the Chinese opened their borders, you might have a situation where there was a collapse from within, where there could be no war because there would be no enemy to fight.
Berlin Wall situation.
That's correct. Yeah. So I think this is also starting to percolate a little bit.
We're speaking with Leonard Spector, the deputy director of the Monterey Institute, about the nuclear weapons programs in North Korea and Iran. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll get to Iran in just a moment, but we wanted to take this question on the line from Al, who's with us from Paramus, New Jersey.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Hey, you guys have a great program. My question was U.S. foreign policy has alienated North Korea so much so that are we at the point of no return, even though the United States is putting a lot on the table to kind of bring North Korea back into the mix? Ever since Bush's speech relating North Korea into the axis of evil, you can only but sympathize with North Korea in terms of its almost paranoia with the United States and its need to defend itself.
Well, I think
my question was: is there a point of no return here?
Are they pushing him into a box?
Well, I think a lot of us are concerned that this may have occurred, and I wouldn't attribute bad motive or necessarily a bad policy to the Bush administration, but certainly as the crisis with Iraq unfolded last fall, you did see the North Koreans, I would say, spoiling for a fight, looking for an excuse to pull out of the so-called agreed framework, which had frozen the plutonium program, and get that thing cranked up again. Now, they must feel very threatened, and I think it is one thing that the talks may alleviate if we can get the right tone and the right set of chips on the table. There has been discussion of a non-aggression pact with North Korea, which might go far toward helping them. And there's an awful lot of money waiting to be poured into the country, if the conditions are right, from Japan, which wants to make reparations for its earlier occupation, from South Korea, which has this idea of integrating North Korea with North Korea in an economic way, and from others. So there's plenty to offer, and I think there is still an opportunity to make this work.
Al, thanks very much. Now, moving on to Iran, obviously a very different place and a very different situation. North Korea, for example, has withdrawn from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is still a member, so the IAEA and the UN are very much involved there. And rather than an openly military program like North Korea, the concern in Iran is what purports to be a civilian nuclear power program.
Well, that's right. Now, you have to just use your noggin, so to speak, and figure out what's really going on. When a country builds a single nuclear power plant, it can buy fuel on the open market at a very cheap price because there's a glut, and Russia has offered to pay for this as part of the deal. I mean, it's to be provided, all the fuel for this facility. So you have to ask yourself, why does Iran need a uranium enrichment capability, which purportedly is for fueling such a plant? Obviously, what they really want to do is enrich the uranium further and bring it up to weapons level. They have a second set of facilities oriented toward producing plutonium, which is very disturbing. And I think no one who looks at this program closely doubts what they're up to.
Mm-hmm. The most recent news from Iran was a detection of traces, and very tiny traces, you have to say, of what appears to be enriched uranium. If that's true, what would that mean?
Well, it means two things. First, almost certainly that it means that the uranium was enriched in Iran, which means they have learned how to do this at least at some rudimentary level. And once you get the trick, you sort of duplicate this over and over again until you have enriched uranium to weapon grade. Secondly, it means that despite the pledge under the Non-Proliferation Treaty that they are supposed to be putting all of their nuclear activities under inspection, and the trigger is when you introduce nuclear materials into a facility, they obviously did not do so. So we have a straightforward violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, it would seem.
And finally, I mean, if Iran were found to be in violations of its obligations under the NPT by the IAEA, it would refer to the Security Council, what could they do?
Well, I think there are a number of steps that can be taken. Certainly there could be an international outcry pressuring to have Iran place all of these under still more stringent inspection. to give inspectors roaming rights under something called the additional protocol mm-hmm. to the existing agreement.
And I'm going to stop you there. Leonard Spector, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Earlier we reported Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez about 20 minutes ago confirmed rumors we've been heard all day about, well, I'm not afraid we're not going to have time for this tape, but we're going to play this cut of tape, which I'm sure you will hear later today on All Things Considered. U.S. military officials now formally declaring that Uday and Qusay Hussein, the sons of Saddam Hussein, were killed in a firefight with U.S. forces outside of the northern Iraqi city of Mosul earlier today. There will be full reporting from Baghdad and Washington on these developments later today on All Things Considered. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.